رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين وحبيب الله العالمين أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد والصلاة والسلام على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأصل والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I want to again continue in our fiqh and the ahkam that we've been going over for the last little while, and I have two rulings to mention today which are actually interrelated in terms of the Salatul Jamaat. And probably this will most likely be the last discussion on Salatul Jamaat. We've covered most of the basics and most of the issues where we sometimes have a bit more confusion in terms of how to perform it, how to connect, how to join. So hopefully this will be the last one. We'll go on to something different after this week's discussion. But the one thing I did want to talk about tonight is about the beginning of the Salat. And as we've mentioned in the past, the way that the Jamaat prayers are performed is that the followers perform all of the actions after the Imam of the Jamaat. If somebody was to accidentally go and do an action slightly before or come out of an action slightly before the Imam of the Jamaat, if it's not done intentionally, there's not a problem. Your prayers are still valid and the Jamaat prayers are still okay. But one of the things that we have to be aware of, and because we see this happen often, so I wanted to make note of it, is that the Takbiratul Ihram that we recite to begin the prayers, we have to be very careful that those who are, especially behind the Imam of the Jamaat, but everybody who are praying the Jamaat prayers, that they don't say the Takbiratul Ihram before the Imam of the Jamaat has completed it. So until the word Allahu Akbar is complete, we should not be actually initiating the Takbiratul Ihram. Again, other actions in the prayers, if we do them a bit before the Imam, going to ruku a bit before, going into sajda, going into kunut, there's not a big problem, especially if it's not done intentionally. But as Sayyid Sistani mentions, that a follower must not, and he has must not, which means it's his fatwa, it's his ruling on this issue. He must not say the Takbiratul Ihram before the Imam. And he says, in fact, the recommended precaution is that he should not say Takbiratul Ihram until the Imam has completed to saying it. So again, it's a very important point because this could actually nullify our Jamaat prayers. And this is where there's a bit of the difference between the Jamaat and the Farada. There is a possibility your Jamaat prayer could be okay, but or your Jamaat prayer would be void, but if you were to follow the rules of a Farada individual prayer, it would be okay. But in this case, if one was to make the Takbir before the Imam of the Jamaat completes it, there is obviously a strong possibility that your Jamaat prayer would be null and void. And because you're not then following the rules of an individual prayer, even that individual would not be actually accepted by Allah. The second thing I want to mention is just a bit about the actual lineup and the formation. Excuse my graphics, I'm not a good designer, so I just put something really quickly together. But I just want to mention a few important points about how we have the Jamaat prayer. So obviously we have the Imam who stands in the front. These are all the men behind him and the ladies to the right. Ladies could also be behind the men. In a lot of communities you'll see this. The women are not behind a wall or a partition. They're behind the men, and that format is also acceptable. But just a few of the points I wanted to mention in relation to this. So we have the partition between the genders. The gap which exists between the people, so where your feet are and where the person behind you, where they're doing sajda, Sayyid Sistani mentions that gap is, the way he describes it, it should not be more than the space needed for a person to perform a normal sajda. So, you know, maybe 6 inches to 12 inches would be sufficient. If it's anything more than that, that would be a problem with the connection in the Jamaat. So whatever the average amount of room is needed for a person to put their head down on the turba is what the gaps are. And that's why even when we have the green cloth laid out, you'll see that the gap is, you know, maybe 6 inches or less between where the heels of the person would end and where the sajda of the person behind him or her would begin. Another point he mentions in terms of the congregational lines, he says the maximum gap. So now we obviously ask people to be close together, shoulder to shoulder as much as possible. He says the maximum gap. So if there was ever a gap, he says the maximum is no more than a large normal step. And when he defined in his new version of his Islamic laws, when he defines what a large normal step is, he says it's about 1 meter. It's about 3.3 feet, I believe it is. So if you were praying Jamaat and you were standing here and somebody happened to leave the Jamaat, if that gap between you and the next person is less than a meter, you would still maintain a connection to that Jamaat. So you wouldn't have to go and change your niyat and go into a furada mode for that prayer. So that's the maximum. Obviously, ideally, we should be as close together. But if a gap does come, somebody, you know, loses their wudu or something happens and they have to leave the Jamaat prayer, then as long as that gap is less than 3 feet between you and the next person, your Jamaat prayer would be okay. And the last part on this slide, well, the second last part, is the gap between the imam and the person directly behind him. So as we mentioned in the past, the person who stands directly behind the imam of the Jamaat, he is there for a particular purpose. And one was that if the imam was to pass out, he was to faint, obviously somebody would have to, you know, maybe look after him, but whoever is behind the imam, in the ideal situation, that person should slowly move his way up and continue the Jamaat prayer. So whoever stands behind the imam, he has that responsibility. He needs to know the rules of the prayers, proper recitation, and all of those criteria for the imam of the Jamaat. So the gap between the imam, where his heels would be, and that person, again, it's a large footstep, a large step, which is 1 meter or about 3 feet. But say it does mention that the smaller the gap between the imam and the person directly behind him, that is the best thing to do. The last part we'll mention, and we'll go on with our topic for tonight, is about that ruling that we mentioned about saying the takbiratul ihram. Ideally, the way it should work is that the imam says takbiratul ihram, the person directly behind him says the takbir, and then it should spread out on the right side and the left side. So the imam says his Allahu Akbar, and then the guy right behind him will say Allahu Akbar. And then what should happen ideally is that the rows behind him would also start to say the takbiratul ihram one after the other. Sometimes we see, and then again for the first row and then the second row, we would see the same thing happening. Sometimes we see that the imam says takbir and the person way at the other end says the takbir. It doesn't nullify the Jamaat prayer, but in order to put some order, some discipline within the prayers, the rule is that we should try to follow that the person behind says the takbir and then it spreads out like a wave from the right side and then from to the left side and then from row to row. Now obviously when you go for ziyarat and there's 30, 40, 50,000 people praying, that's not practical because by the time you say your takbir, the imam might be maybe finished the first rakat possibly. So there's different rules and different ways how we perform the Jamaat in those larger congregations. But here where we have a smaller area, we can maintain it, we can manage it. Ideally, this is what should happen is, again, the imam says it, the person behind him, and then it should spread out from the rows on both sides. We finish this part, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the ability to, again, understand His rulings and that we can implement and follow His teachings in our life in every step of the way of the ibadat of Allah. One salawat upon Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, please. Tonight and randomly during the next little while that we are on the Thursday night programs and there's no other official event happening, I wanted to go through Dua Kumail. You know, it's a beautiful supplication that we as a community have inherited from the master of the pious, the leader of those who have taqwa, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali, alayhi salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. And there are so many beautiful, obviously the entire dua itself is a beautiful way that Imam is talking to Allah. And in these discussions, I want to just pick out certain segments of the dua and to do a bit of a reflection on what the Imam is asking Allah for. Because obviously when we look at any of the supplications from the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, we understand that a dua is not just something that we come to the center to listen to watch on a screen, but rather it's us calling upon Allah. Even this word dua, it literally means to call upon. So when we are calling upon Allah, obviously the best way to call upon Allah is knowing what we're saying to Him. And because we might not be familiar with the Arabic language and with the nuances in the way that the Imams have put these words together, I thought it would be good to spend a bit of time looking at certain portions of the dua and to see where we can actually fully benefit from the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. So tonight in this first lecture, first discussion in the reflections of Dua Kamil, I want to look at the topic of breaking the sin barrier and see how Amir al-Mu'mineen speaks about this in the dua. And again, I'm not going to go through it line by line of the dua, but just I want to choose certain passages for us. But before I actually go into the line, I just want to give us a brief understanding of who Kamil is. Kamil has a very interesting history. I don't want to go into a lot of it tonight because I'm still doing some research on it. So hopefully next discussion I'll share with us more of how he came to Islam, because it's a very interesting narrative of him and his tribe becoming Muslims. But he was from Yemen. So the country that we see today that Saudi is bombing incessantly, Kamil came from that region, from that area of Yemen. They say that he was actually born 7 years before Rasulullah migrated from Mecca to Medina. And he, obviously after the coming of Islam, him and his tribe and his community basically en masse come into Islam as believers. And he becomes, although he's not really officially listed as a companion of Rasulullah, although he lived at the time of the Messenger, but we still refer to him as a companion of the Messenger. He was definitely a close confidant and a supporter of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He didn't accept the Khilafat of the first three Khalifas. He pledged his allegiance only to Imam Ali. After Imam Ali, he gave his allegiance to Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and also to Imam Hussein after the death of Imam Hassan. But it's interesting because from this point on, actually, he actually gets imprisoned and thrown in jail. And that's why even though he lived till the year 83 after Hijri, he wasn't in Karbala. And we know when we look at history, we see it on the names of the Shuhada, many Sahaba are missing in Karbala that we would have thought would have been there with Imam Hussein. But he was one of the companions who was actually imprisoned by Muawiyah and Yazid way before the event. And actually, according to one of the references that I found the other day, he was actually released the day after Ashura. So it's almost as if they knew that he would have been there with Imam Hussein in Karbala, and to prevent him and Qambar and many other of the Sahaba, they kept him in prison until the 11th of Muharram, and then he was released. So he lives till 83, and unfortunately we don't have much history after Karbala. So he's released on the 11th of Muharram. And you would think, well, he would be there with the fourth imam and the fifth imam. But we don't have, at least what I was able to find, we don't have much in history of what happens to Kamil during the time of the fourth and fifth imam. But we do know in the year 83 after the Hijri, Hajjaj, who I'm sure we've all heard of, a tyrannical ruler, he kills Kamil as well as many other loyal sahaba of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So he lived to be about 90 years old. And obviously the reason why we give him that love and respect, being a close companion of the first three imams, is because he also narrates to us what we just recited of Dua Kamil. So this was a dua that Imam Ali actually taught to Kamil. Originally it was called the Dua of Khidr, but because Kamil is the one who narrates it to us and we get it from him, so we've all been accustomed to referring to it as the Dua of Kamil. So the one thing I want to look at tonight is right in the beginning where Imam talks about sins and about some of the sins that bring about certain difficulties within our lives. And so the first thing I want to look at before I go to the line is, why do we sin? Why is it that as believers, as followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, as Muslims, why do we get caught up in sinning? We know what is right and what is wrong. Allah tells us in the Quran that every human being has that nature to know right from wrong. We know what is permissible, we know what is impermissible. when we come into Islam or we come into the madrasa system and the majalis, we hear things which are allowed to do, things which are not allowed to do. So we know it from a theoretical perspective. We know right from wrong as Muslims and as human beings. But our scholars tell us that there are usually two reasons why we sin. One are external factors, and the other one are internal factors. External meaning the societies that we're in. You know, sometimes when we live in an environment, in a society which is full of sin, full of, you know, people doing what they want to do, whatever feels right for them, as we see in our society today, and even at the time of the Prophet and the Imams, it was a similar situation. Sometimes those external factors get the best of us, right? We have peer pressure, and peer pressure isn't just for the young men and women who are in school and you know, teenagers. Even sometimes adults, our friends, maybe our own family, maybe they try and influence and impact us to do things which are not in line with the ethos of Islam. So sometimes external factors can cause us to break the laws of Allah, and sometimes it's internal, that we know what is right, we know what is wrong, but we, for our own personal benefit, maybe it's material benefit, maybe it's the ego, it's my nafs, that I want to, you know, do something or say something, knowing that it's wrong, but to appease a part of my inside, I will sometimes break the rules of Allah. In both of these cases, the external and the internal factors, we end up unfortunately committing sins. And one of the beautiful parts of Dua Kumail is that in four or five lines, Amir al-Mu'mineen points to certain factors. He gives us just a brief glimpse into certain factors that cause us to slip away from Allah. And one of the beauties is that when the fourth Imam comes along, Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salatu wassalam, the fourth Imam takes these lines of Dua Kumail, this Allahumma ghfirli adhanub al-lati that we repeat four or five times, depending on the narration of Dua Kumail, and the fourth Imam gives us explanations of what those sins are, or what those actions are. So tonight I want to look at just at one of the lines of the Dua, in which the Imam says, Allahumma ghfirli adhanub al-lati tahtikul isam. And this is the very first part of the dua after we praise Allah and we extol the virtues of Allah, where we say, Oh Allah, forgive me those sins which tear apart the safeguards from committing further sins. It's almost as if we're in a bubble. We as mu'min, as believers, are within a protective bubble, that we are protected from certain sins, from doing certain acts of iniquity against the rules of Allah. But there are certain sins and actions that we can perform that pop that bubble. And once that bubble is popped, then basically there is a greater chance that we may fall into even greater sins. So if you can imagine it as we're protected by a bubble, an invisible bubble around us, this ismat, this protection from sinning. But there are certain actions that we may perform that will actually pop that bubble. And that would allow, that would give room for Satan and for our temptations to actually go and go further against the rules of Allah. So I want to look tonight at, in brief, at what these sins are that the Imam has talked about. When the fourth Imam gave commentary of this verse, of this passage of the dua, he said that this barrier that is broken, this ismat that we would have that can be penetrated, is basically dissolved by these five sins, and these break that sin barrier. One of them is intoxicants of any form, liquid, solid, and whatever else, you know, modern science will come up with. And we'll look at these in brief tonight as well, just one or two, one hadith or one verse of the Quran about each of them. Gambling in any form, whether it be the lottery, the Lotto 649, whether it be the casinos, online, people think, well, I'm online gambling. I'm not harming anybody. I'm not going to, you know, Casinorama or whatever. No, online gambling is no different. If it's on your smartphone or in the casino, there's no difference. Number three, Imam says, is useless speech. And people who make others laugh just for the fun of it. You know, comedians, stand-up comics. This also is one of those things when we engage in it excessively, It can break that protection that we have and can get us to be performing other sins. Number four, the fourth Imam says, is when you point out people's defects and shortcomings and deficiencies. And number five is where we stay and we are in the company of people who openly sin. Just being around those people, the Imam says, not even us sinning. We're good people, but we hang around with sinners. The fourth Imam says that in itself has the potential to break that protection, that protective bubble around us, enabling us to actually go further in the transgression of the laws of Allah. So the first one that we have is intoxication, is anything that which intoxicates an individual. There's a hadith that I wanted to refer to here from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he says, where he was asked by a companion, the companion asked Imam Ali, he says, have you said that wine is worse than theft and adultery? And Imam confirmed this, and he says, an adulterer may not commit any other sin, so he or she just does adultery, that's it. But he says, when someone drinks alcohol, then they may commit adultery, murder, and even leave their prayers. So really, when we look at it from one perspective, alcohol, intoxicants, drugs, hallucinogenics, marijuana, whatever format you talk about, these have the potential to fog over the mind. And we know about this. You read the newspaper every day and how many people are killed from drunk drivers. How many women are raped because of men who get drunk and they go to a party and they do things which they shouldn't have done. So Imam Ali shows us that, yes, adultery itself is a sin. But alcohol, if you want to weigh the evilness, alcohol can make you do multiple sins, not just drinking. You could kill somebody. You could injure somebody. You could, you know, violate somebody's personal space. You can do so many things just through alcohol, just through intoxicants. And so Islam shows us that not only is drinking alcohol haram for you and I, but even to deal with alcohol is haram. The hadith from Rasulullah tells us that everybody, from the person who grew the grapes, for example, to produce alcohol, to the person who harvests it, to the person who transports it, to the person who creates the alcohol, who bottles it, who sells it, who distributes it, all of these people are cursed within the teachings of Rasulullah. And even we know in contemporary times, the Maraja tell us, even us Muslims to work in a restaurant that is licensed is haram. If you have to work in X restaurant that serves alcohol and you as a waiter or waitress have to serve alcohol to another person, even a person who doesn't believe alcohol to be forbidden, this is a sin in Islam. To own a grocery store, a convenience store, where you have to sell alcohol, this is a problem in Islam. Yes, there are certain other things which are haram. For example, meat, which isn't slaughtered Islamically. We can get away with selling that, not a problem. Lottery tickets, there is legal loopholes in Islam to allow us to, if we have a convenience store and we have to sell them, there is a legal loophole to get out with or to get away with selling that. But with alcohol, really, there is no legal loophole that you can find or ask the marja or look in the hadith or ayat. Alcohol, basically, in all of its, rather intoxicants and all of its forms, are prohibited in the tradition of Islam. The second sin that Imam mentions within these passages is gambling. And as I mentioned, it doesn't only include going to a casino. That was the way 10, 15, 20 years ago. But today we know that lottery tickets, you go shopping for your groceries and lottery tickets are there. You go to fill up gas, lottery tickets are available. You have your smartphones, people can gamble online. People can use their computers and gamble. So any form of gambling according to Islam is prohibited. But not only that, our scholars tell us that not only is it prohibited to gamble, but even to use the instruments of gambling for fun is not allowed. So guys who just get together and hang out and play poker with poker chips, not betting money, this is haram. Scholars even go a step further and say even many of the card games you might play on your smartphone are also haram, even if in the digital format. So poker, blackjack, all of these games, even if you play it on your phone, you download the app and you play it just to pass time, This also is prohibited. Now you may wonder why. Why would the marja say that that is haram? You're not gambling. You're not causing any harm, apparently. But they have their reasons. They have their rationale why they say that even the instruments of gambling are also prohibited for a believer to use. Number three in this list of things that our fourth imam has given to us, the explanation from Dua Kamail, is useless speech and making people laugh just to pass time. Now we know that as believers, we've obviously been created for a purpose on earth. We have a goal in life. Allah has created us for a goal. And each and every one of us should also have goals in our life, whether it be, you know, at work, at school, whatever the case may be. And so Islam tells us to take the life of this world seriously. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have fun. It doesn't mean as Muslims we don't go and play sports or play video games or go on vacation and just, you know, chill and relax. If it's being done with the right intention, as we talked about before, any action that we do can become an act of worship. So if people are getting together and playing sports to increase the brotherhood and the sisterhood and the unity of the community, even if it's, you know, basketball or hockey or whatever the case may be, 3-4 hours goes. But if they're doing it with that intention to be with one another, then that is an act of worship. It doesn't fall into this category. Playing video games might seem like a waste of time, but if it's done with that intention and there's nothing wrong in the game, it's not one of those violent games with, you know, suggestive, you know, scenes and a plot, then these things, again, we can put it, we can group it. If it's being done for the right reason, then that can also fall into the same category. But basically, how the scholars determine this is to say that if it doesn't benefit you in this world or in the next world, then it can go into this bucket of being useless, whether it be speech or texting or typing or WhatsApping or, you know, watching things just to pass time, these miniseries and dramas and soap operas that are come on television or on the internet, or, you know, stand-up comedians, to an extent that that even is a waste of time because there's no benefit in any of these things. Now again, Islam is not saying that don't have fun, don't enjoy the life. It allows us to have fun within limits. It allows us to enjoy the life of this world within certain limits that Islam has put for us. The fourth thing that the fourth imam explains in terms of this line from Dua Kamail is he says that when we speak, pointing out rather people's deficiencies, their shortcomings, and any weaknesses. And here speaking, I don't mean just picking up the phone and talking to somebody, but it could be texting, emailing, messaging somebody. You know, you say, oh, did you see that brother today? He looks like this. He's overweight. He's like this. He's like that. This is a form of ghibah, is a form of backbiting. Or we talk about maybe their financial status. You know, sometimes I hear that on the ladies' side in certain communities, you know, if a sister wears the same outfit twice to the majlis, people will start pointing fingers. Well, didn't you wear that outfit last time at the waladat of the imam? Why are you wearing it again? As if we have to have an outfit for every single event. Or she has one purse that she spent $800 on buying a purse, and now she has to buy another one because she already used that one time at a majlis. Because if she doesn't bring in a new purse or a new outfit or a new pair of shoes or a new ring or something, then people will start talking about her and pointing fingers at her. And then the messages will start going back and forth. People will start phoning. Did you see what that sister wore? They'll text other, oh, she wore that same outfit 2 weeks ago. All of these things, whether it's the person's physical appearance, it's the morals, their behavior, their material, their religious deficiencies. Maybe somebody doesn't know how to pray and we make fun of them. Why make fun? Why not go and help them learn how to pray properly? Somebody isn't doing something right in Islam. They don't know. Why not go and teach and help them and guide them rather than go and talk behind their back and make fun of them and laugh at them? And this brings me to this next hadith from Rasulullah, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. It's a beautiful and powerful hadith, and we'll end with this. He says, O you who have simply embraced Islam verbally, but have not wholeheartedly come into the religion. Do not blame Muslims, and do not go in search of their faults. And anyone who chases after a Muslim's faults, Allah will chase after his faults or her faults. It's gender neutral. And if Allah chases someone's faults, rest assured that he will disgrace that person, even if that person was hiding in his own home. Right? So who are we as Muslims to point the finger at other people and say, well, that sister does that and that brother's doing that? You know, look at it. When you point the finger, there's three fingers pointing back at you. So if you're going to point one defect or one flaw in somebody else's character, look at ourselves, and we probably have the same thing that we're accusing that person of, or maybe even worse within ourselves. We only see the apparent of that person, but they don't see our hidden sins that we commit. So rather than us worrying about other people and what woman is wearing this and she wore that and how many purses she has and what kind of car the person drives and how big is their house, let's worry about ourselves, think about ourselves, think about our own akhirat, our own next world. Really, it's not worth it to pick and look at other people and to pry into their lives. And then worse than that, we go and spread and talk about it in society. We go and tell other people and we talk about them, not realizing that again at the end of the day that we also have shortcomings. And just as we want Allah to hide our defects, we have to be ready to hide those of other people. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. And the fifth and last of the barriers that cause us to further sin is staying and being in the company of people who are sinners. As we mentioned, it's one thing if we sin, or if we don't sin rather, but a problem comes if we hang out with people who are sinners. And that's why Islam even tells us, for young and old alike, for men and women, that be careful of who your friends are. Be careful of who you hang out with. Be careful of who you spend time with. Are they people of good character? Are they people who sin, who go to the clubs, who drink, who smoke, who do drugs? Because if they are, you might not do that. But A, you will be impacted by them through peer pressure. And B, you'll be associated as being amongst them, even if you yourself are not doing those same actions. And this is clear. We have so many examples in front of us that it doesn't even, you know, we don't even have to go into them. But here's a beautiful hadith from Jesus Christ, Prophet Isa alayhi salam, where he stated, "Show your friendship with Allah by loathing the sinners. You will approach Allah's grace by retreating from them." Then Jesus was asked, "O Spirit of God, O Ruhullah, who should we accompany? Who should we be friends with?" He said, "Be with those people whose company reminds you of Allah, whose speech increases your knowledge, and whose behavior, whose akhlaq, whose morals make you desire the world to come, the akhirat." And it's a challenge in today's day and age to find people like that. How do we find people who, when you hang out with them, they make you remember Allah? Because again, when we hang out with certain people, sometimes they're doing ghibat, they're talking about other people, they're talking about all the stuff that they bought, about how much money they're making, about vacations, about trips. But who sits and has a majlis at home and invites friends just to talk about Allah, just to engage in the dhikr and the remembrance of Allah? It's very, maybe it happens, but it's few and far between. When we hang out with people, we don't look and seek knowledge of Islam. Maybe we're looking how to make a fast buck, where the investments are the best, who's investing in this, and what's hitting in the stock market, where should I put my money? But are we looking for friends that can actually give us knowledge of Islam, which will benefit us in the world to come? And are we looking for people that will help us to remember the akhirat? Because it's easy to remember the dunya. We're in the dunya today. We're in this world. And we have so many ways to remember the world. But do we have somebody, a friend, that we can call a true friend, that can spark that thought in our head about the akhirat, about the day of accountability, the day of resurrection? And if we have those friends, that's great. We should keep them and we should try and maintain that friendship. And if we don't, then we need to look for such individuals within our lives. We end and we ask Allah, through the blessings of Kumail ibn Ziyad and the beautiful dua that he has given to us And this is his shrine in Iraq. For those who have not been, this is where Kumail is buried. We ask Allah that we are able to benefit from Kumail ibn Ziyad, from his dua, from his intercession. And that through remembering him in this way, that we can ask Allah to give us Kumail's shafa'at on the day of resurrection. We ask Allah to keep us all in the under the banner of the walayat of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. We ask Allah to keep our families, our spouses, our children, all on the path of Islam and the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. We ask Allah to forgive us our sins, to keep us on Siratul Mustaqim, to give the thawab of this program tonight to the marhumin, to the deceased from this community, from all of our family, our friends, the ulama who have left this world, the shuhada who have left this world. And lastly, but not least, we ask Allah to hasten in the dhuhur, the advent of our 12th Imam, Imam Al-Hujjah, and that we can live to see the dawn, the day of the dawn of our 12th Imam. Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-sami'ul 'alim. For Kumail ibn Ziyad, for all the noble sahaba of Amir al-Mu'mineen, let us recite one surah al-Fatiha. Before that, one loud salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allah Muhammad, Ali Muhammad.